Okay, so first of all, the people in the back seats, can you all hear me? If you can, please put up your hands. Yes, very good. So tonight's Dhamma talk, these talks which I'm giving every evening are especially for those who are here on the meditation retreat, but it's also some very interesting Dhamma, some interesting truths for those who are just coming into the evening talk as well. The subject for this evening is superpower mindfulness. Each one of you who have come to these talks knows just the importance of mindfulness. And I mentioned last night that mindfulness has many different degrees to it. And this evening I'm going to show you what superpower mindfulness is, how it's developed, and what its usefulness is. Many of you know that Buddhism is a training of the mind, and by training the mind in these methods and skills of meditation, we do actually get a powerful mind, and that is experienced as superpower mindfulness. But in order to train the mind, I have to understand a couple of interesting facts. And the first is that in order to train the body, in order to make the body strong and fit, we have to exercise the body. But this was a teaching from my master, Ajahn Chah. He said that's the way to get a fit and strong body, to exercise it. But the opposite is the case with our mind. He said to get a strong and fit mind, you have to keep it peaceful and still. And it's through the stillness of the mind that the mind starts to become empowered. This is one of the reasons why people have got weak minds in our current age. It's simply because that we think too much, we work so hard, our minds move so fast and so often that they haven't got much strength left. It is one of the reasons why in our modern age there are many people suffer psychological problems, even to the point of depression, simply because they may have fit bodies, but they have very weak minds. I think many of you would know, those of you above 50, 60 years of age, that depression is a modern phenomenon. You never heard of so many people getting depressed 30, 40, 50 years ago. And it's one of the causes of this depression is our lifestyles, where we don't know how to rest our mind. So to be able to rest the mind, we have to go in a different direction than we usually go in life. Which is why the first day of this retreat, you might find this very strange. What am I supposed to do? Please give me some more instructions. I'm lost. Very often, the first day of a retreat is very difficult, simply because you're going in a different direction than normal. In the story of the Lord Buddha's enlightenment, you remember a most important occasion where the Buddha-to-be put his alms bowl in the river Niranjara, just next to Bodh Gaya, and he made a resolution that if I have the karma to become fully enlightened, to become a Buddha, may my bowl flow against the current, may it go upstream, not downstream. Now of course, that's something very strange for something to float against the current. But according to the story, his bowl did flow against the current. And that was taken as a signal that he would soon become a Buddha, fully enlightened. But it was not just a prophecy, not just an omen. It also gave some indication on what you had to do to become enlightened. To go against the stream of craving. To go against the stream of doing, to go against the current of always wanting to manage things, to go in the opposite direction than you normally go in everyday life. Which is why for the first day or two of the retreat, sometimes people feel, what am I supposed to be doing? It's good that you're stopping. Soon you will reverse direction, and you will go into this beautiful state of mind, born of letting go. To understand even more fully what I mean by going in the opposite direction, we can understand that there are two parts to your mind. This is a way of looking at the mind, which you can see in the suttas, but I emphasize this in order to understand what meditation truly is, and how the happiness, the power of meditation, occurs. And it also means that you'll understand what these hindrances to meditation are, and how to overcome. This way of looking at the mind, this map, will show you where everything is and what direction you'll need to go. This particular way of looking at the mind divides it into two parts. The first part is the passive part. The mindfulness, the consciousness, the knowing. It's that part of you which can hear me as I speak, which can see me, which can feel the body. It's the passive, receiving, knowing mind. The other half of your mind is what reacts, what does. It is the active part of the mind. This is what thinks, what manages, what moves, what reacts to what it experiences. It's called the doing mind. Once you understand those two parts of your mind, the passive knowing mind and the reactive doing mind, everything becomes quite clear in the way of our meditation. The purpose of this meditation is to calm down the active doing mind, to let go of all of the craving, the managing, the reacting. Which is why I said yesterday, it doesn't matter what you're experiencing, make peace with it. What that meant was actually suppressing the active, reactive, doing part of your mind. What happens is that usually the reactive, active, doing part of your mind takes up most of your mental energy. Most of the time we are spending just thinking, managing, speaking to ourselves, planning, remembering, figuring things out. This is always the active part of the mind. When you are meditating, it's what causes all the restlessness, all the internal gossip, all the worry, all the concern. It even causes the boredom which sometimes come up in your mind. And it also causes the sleepiness and the restlessness. The reason it causes this is because it uses up so much energy that you haven't got much left simply to know. Because all the energy of your mind gets used in reacting, there's hardly anything left for knowing. To give an example, it's like people speaking or listening. Too many people are speaking and not enough people are listening. The listening is the passive part. The speaking is the active part. When I say so many people are speaking, I mean even when someone is talking, very often there are so many thoughts going on in a person's mind. They're not listening to the words of the speaker. Too often they're listening to the thoughts which accompany the speaker. Which means they're not fully listening. They're not simply knowing. They're reacting to what's being said. So when we're meditating, the first part is to subdue the active part of the mind. When we subdue the active part of the mind, the energies which we have in our mind, the natural energies, have a chance to flow to the knowing mind. They don't flow anymore to the active doing mind, they flow to the knowing mind instead. Your energies can go in one of those two ways, to the knowing mind or to the active doing mind. But if they're wasted in the doing mind, there's hardly anything left for knowing. So here we're not doing anything. Here we're not reacting. As I said yesterday, it's not the noise disturbs you. You disturb the noise. You're reacting to things. When you stop reacting to things, use your mindfulness. Let's stop, don't do this. Just know, just allow it to be, this is good enough. Then you find that when the energy starts to flow into the knowing mind gets charged up. That which knows tends to become more and more powerful and more bright. It's as if that you can see with more color, with more depth, you can hear more, you can feel more, you can know more. This is all part of the knowing mind. Literally, you brighten up. It's like a person who goes out into the night with only a small flashlight, whose batteries are almost dead anyway. You can't see very much. That is like a normal person's mind, which has not been energized yet. And it's usually what happens on the first day of a retreat. It takes a while for the energies to build up in a knowing mind. So the first day of your retreat, you get tired, you get bored, nothing seems to happen. That is par for the course. Don't worry about it. Just be patient. But certainly don't react to it. Don't start thinking and worrying. Because that way you're losing more energy, more mind energy. So by not doing things, by not reacting, the energies have more chance to build up. The batteries in the flashlight get stronger and stronger. And soon they get so strong that the energies of the mind build up. You have power mindfulness. You can see more of what's going on. You can feel more. And the example I gave of this yesterday, and it's an example which I think you'll all become aware of in the next few days. Whenever you go on a meditation retreat, you will find the food starts to taste more delicious every day. I first discovered this on one of the first retreats I did, which was in Cambridge when I was still a student there. A little meditation group hired a boarding house for students in Cambridge. Now, if any of you have been to England 30, 40 years ago, you would know that the food there is not delicious. Actually, it's quite disgusting. Everything is boiled until any flavour which was once in the natural product is completely disappeared. And the boarding houses, because they were looking after students with a very, very small budget, they were the lowest of the low when it comes to gastronomical scales. They were terrible cooks. And so that when I heard that we were going to have a retreat and all the food was going to be cooked by one of these boarding house landladies, I thought, oh, this isn't going to be fun. But the opposite happened. The food in this boarding house was actually quite tasty. In fact, it was really delicious. And I thought that, my goodness, we must have struck lucky. I must have had such good karma that we got the best boarding house cooks in the whole of the city. I couldn't believe how delicious these boiled potatoes were. And everyone else agreed. It was only later I realized that was just an ordinary cook. It was nothing to do with the cook or even the ingredients or the way they were put together. But it was everything to do with the fact that my mindfulness was becoming powerful. And any little ingredients which were there, any small tastes and flavors, I were picking them all up. It's as if my senses were being amplified. So the small little tastes were there. I could really appreciate them. That's why it started feeling delicious. And that's why when you eat the food here, once the mindfulness really starts to take off, my goodness, the food here will be just so tasty. For those of you who aren't on this retreat, the moral of this story is, if ever you go out for dinner one evening, make sure you meditate first of all, so that you can get power mindfulness, you can enhance your senses, and you'll be able to enjoy your food even more. The point is, you're more alert, more aware, you can feel more, your depth of perception is strengthened. Now, of course, we're not meditating just to enjoy our food, but this is a byproduct which, once you notice this, should be telling you something very important. That when you do, when you do start to stop this doing business and put more attention into the knowing, your mind becomes stronger and more powerful. When it becomes stronger and more powerful, then when you start to take up your meditation objects like loving kindness or the breath, it becomes more easy to do. You can see more and the breath appears more delicious. One of the reasons why, when people do the meditation on the breath, that many people just give up, it's because they don't prepare themselves well enough first of all. You have to prepare some mindfulness first of all, and have that mindfulness strong enough, bright enough, so you can watch the breath and it's not boring anymore. But it's quite wonderful to see. It's what I sometimes call the beautiful breath. And once your mindfulness becomes very strong, you watch this breath, wow, this is amazing, this is lovely, this is beautiful. Sometimes people think I'm crazy when I talk like this. How can the breath be just like that? But I tell you, if mashed potatoes in boarding houses in England are delicious, then the breath is just amazing and wonderful. All it is your mindfulness is becoming more powerful. The byproduct of that is whatever you see in life, whatever you feel, whatever you hear, also becomes enhanced. Literally, it enriches your life. You become a person because of that increased mindfulness who can see more, feel more deeply, know more, and you enjoy your life much more. People who are depressed have got very low mindfulness. The energies of their mind are all used up. And so what they actually see is like the colours all washed out. There's no brightness anymore. There's no sort of colour and depth. It's just like the first time I went to visit my family after I became a monk in London. My brother, it was in November, and my brother was telling me that there was a type of depression which had just been found in the Northern Hemisphere, which only occurred around that time of the year. People were getting depressed simply because there was nothing bright and colourful in Northern Europe at that time. It was true, because when I went there, you looked up at the sky. Yeah, the sun only came up about 9 o'clock. Up until 9 o'clock, 9:30, it was dark. And then about midday, you know, it was sort of like twilight here in Ipoh. And then about 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, it was dark again. I remember as a kid in the winter time, you go to school in the dark, you come home in the dark, because it was, you know, far north. But there was only a little light, and what light there was very grey. Even the clouds, you looked up in the clouds, it was all grey. All the buildings, you've been to London, no one paints the buildings, they're all grey stone building or grey brick building. And all the streets were just grey. And look at the clothes people used to wear in London. There was no colours, no bright yellows or greens or red. They all wore grey overcoats. It was all grey everywhere. And even the tea which the British liked to drink, what was it called? Oh, grey. Everything was grey. So no wonder people got depressed. And you know what these psychologists did? To take these people out of the depression, they didn't even need to give them any drugs. They just put them in a room, turned up the lights, they got them to wear Hawaiian shirts if they were men, and brightly coloured floral dresses if they were women. They put on some loud music. Everything was bright and colourful. And the depression went. All it was their senses weren't being stimulated enough. And the mind, the brain, was simply turning off because there's nothing to do. They were going into this dull depression. Now what happens with superpower mindfulness or power mindfulness, it is like doing that but from on the inside. When you start to meditate more, you find all the colours become brighter, the sounds become deeper, the feelings become more intense, they're like amplified. And with that, you become happier. This is one of the important parts of meditation, that once mindfulness starts to become stronger, the depression, the washed out feeling of life, that nothing is interesting, everything is bland, even your food doesn't taste good, just life becomes a bit meaningless. And that's only because your mindfulness has got very weak. Once you start meditating and your mindfulness starts to increase because you're not encouraging the doer, the reactor, but you're actually stopping and allowing the energy to flow into the mindfulness, everything becomes brighter. And with that, life becomes more beautiful. With that, you get a natural happiness, a joy. Sometimes people ask me, Ajahn Brahm, why are you always so happy? You're a monk. Why are you... You can't do this, you can't listen to music, you can't watch movies, you can't have sex, you can't even choose what food you have. Even when you do get the food you like, usually I eat in a bowl and it all gets mixed up together. Sometimes people do give you ice cream, but you have to put it on top of your curry. So they say, how can you have fun as a monk? Being a monk must be so hard. But those of you who know me, have you ever heard me complain? I'm having a good time as a monk. Where does that energy and happiness come from? It comes from the mind. When you calm the mind down and all the energy starts to flow into just knowing, everything becomes fun. You start to get happiness. The meditation starts to get bubbly instead of boring. You know that sometimes that people just don't know how to meditate. They get so dull, they try so hard, and that just takes up more energy. They've still got a long way from power mindfulness. When you really know how to meditate, you make fun with meditation. Which is why, excuse me, I invented, this is original Ajahn Brahm teaching, no one else has taught this, I invented the way of meditating called backwards breath meditation. Have you ever meditated on the breath backwards? Have you ever heard how to do that before? Meditating on the breath backwards? No? Well, you've heard it if you've been on one of my retreats before, it's one of my teachings. To meditate on the breath backwards means instead of what most people do, they watch the breath breathing in, then breathing out, breathing in, breathing out. This time, you breathe out first and then you breathe in. So you try that. You breathe out first and then you breathe in, and you find it's completely different. It's what I call backward breath meditation. You try it. It's good fun. So if you get bored when you're doing this meditation retreat, try doing backwards breath meditation. Breathing out, breathing in, breathing out, breathing in. You'll find it's very different. Or, if that doesn't work, you can try the 3 in-breaths to 1 out-breath meditation. There you go, now you're laughing, it's fun. So you play around, because with that playing around in your meditation, you find you're engaged, the mindfulness increases. Have you ever noticed? The stronger the mindfulness, the more fun, the stronger the mindfulness. This is what power mindfulness is. You start to get fun in your meditation and joy. And this is an important part of the path of meditation. If any of you read the way the Buddha taught meditation, you'll find that he encouraged that which he called piti sukha. The joy and the happiness which come from meditation. We encourage that early on in the path of meditation. To get joy coming up. It's a sign of joy, it's a sign that mindfulness is getting strong. When that mindfulness starts to get empowered, the joy and the happiness come up. And when that joy and the happiness come up, you don't feel like going to your dormitory and just crashing out. You just want to get back on that cushion as soon as you can. Because it becomes fun to meditate. It's important to get to that stage in your meditation whether meditation is not something you do as some type of penance. You're not doing this because, well, if it hurts, it must be good for me. That is not the way to be a Buddhist. The meditation, after a while, becomes so much fun, so joyful, you can't wait to get on that cushion to do it. The first few days of a retreat, you won't feel that much fun. But if you follow these instructions, after 2 or 3 days, many of you will start feeling happiness. Hey, this is really easy, this is fun. I'm getting a lot of joy and pleasure out of this meditation. And when that starts to happen, yes, when you find, after I finish talking here of an evening, people just carry on sitting. They carry on meditating. 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, and they don't want to go. They just sit here, sometimes all night. Not because they're forcing themselves or trying to prove anything, just because it's fun. They get this happiness and joy coming up. That happiness and joy is a sign that power mindfulness is happening. When you have that power mindfulness, it's so easy no matter what you're watching. If you're watching the breath becomes beautiful. You've really got something to watch. It becomes interesting. It's not that the breath is by itself interesting. When the mind becomes powerful, then the breath is interesting. And with that interest, that joy, it's a very peaceful joy. It's just so still and just so nice and so joyful. If you haven't achieved those states yet, you'll find that you probably will in this retreat. And when it is, you know just how easy it is and what meditation is all about. Because in those states, your mindfulness is getting strong. When those things happen, sometimes people ask, now what should I do? And I said, you've forgotten. That question, now what should I do, is completely wrong. Don't do anything, stupid. Keep it quiet, keep it still. Don't interfere with the process. Leave it alone. It's happening, so just sit there and enjoy it. As you enjoy that peace and that stillness, because you aren't reacting to it, the energies flow even more into the knowing. The mindfulness increases in its power. When you're watching, say, the breath, you can see it so easily, see in so much detail. You can see, say, a breath from the very beginning of an in-breath right to the end of the in-breath. You can see the space between the breaths from the beginning of the out-breath to the end of the out-breath without any effort whatsoever. Your mindfulness has increased, it's become powerful, you can see things. And it's interesting. I read in a booklet many years ago, I think it was in Princeton University in the US, a psychologist did an experiment. He asked for about 7 or 8 volunteers. And the experiment was, they had a simple flower vase, quite a few of them, and they asked these experimenters, they had to pay them, just to sit in the lab all morning and just stare at the vase and keep staring at it. At lunchtime they could go and have lunch for an hour, in the afternoon back there just staring at that vase, the flower vase. After the first session, many of the experimenters got so bored they gave up. But there was a couple of people carried on, not just for one day, for about 2 or 3 days. And one of them, a woman, she was watching that vase, just staring at it after the second day or so. And she said, something happened. The vase suddenly became just so incredibly beautiful and wonderful and lovely. The most beautiful vase she'd ever seen. And then she looked outside the window, and the flowers in the campus were just glowing in their colours. Everything was just so incredibly beautiful. Even in the lab, everything was just brilliant and so full of detail. And it was recorded in the psychology journals. What was happening? Because that she was focusing on one thing for a long time, because she was not reacting, she was not feeding the active part of their mind, because she could stay that long after a while, she got this superpower mindfulness. where the mind becomes so strong and energized, whatever it sees much more deeply and more fully than anyone else can see. And with it, everything becomes so amazingly beautiful. That becomes one of the great payoffs in the meditation retreat. Not only does the food taste exquisite, but sometimes you go outside and you see a little plant, a leaf on a tree, and say, wow, look at that. Again, I experienced this on my first meditation retreat in Cambridge. In the morning we were allowed to go on a walk for exercise outside of the retreat centre, the boarding house. And obviously, knowing the city very well, being a student there, I went straight away to the botanical gardens, which are about 5 minutes walk away. And when I thought I was going to have a nice exercise in the beautiful botanical gardens. But as soon as I got into the entrance, there was this clump of bamboo. And it was so amazingly beautiful. I never seen a clump of bamboo that beautiful before. Just the colours in the stems and just the way those stems gently curved upwards. I know if you've seen those beautiful Chinese paintings of bamboo. It was like that, but only even better. And there was a slight morning breeze and it was just swaying like a ballet dance in the wind. And I stood captivated just with the beauty of that simple clump of bamboo for about 10 minutes. And I thought, if anybody saw me just staring in wonder at that, they'd probably cart me away somewhere. So I saw a bench and sat down. And for the whole 50 minutes I had, I just stared in wonder at this amazing beauty in a clump of bamboo in the Cambridge Botanical Gardens. It was only because I had to be back for the next meditation that I had to leave. I tore myself away. But I went back there the next day. 8 of the 9 days, I went back to that clump of bamboo, and every morning the same thing happened. I just couldn't take my eyes off it. It was just so incredibly beautiful. The most beautiful piece of bamboo in the world. A few days after the retreat had ended, when I was back at my studies, working hard, partying just like any other student, I had a free afternoon. I thought, yeah, I'm going to go and see my most beautiful clump of bamboo. So I got on my bicycle. And I cycled through the Cambridge traffic and I got to the Botanical Gardens. I went in the entrance and I was so disappointed. There at the entrance was this dirty, spindly, dry clump of bamboo. Because bamboo doesn't go very well in the northern climate or in the weather of England. It's not warm enough. It was just so weak and dirty and dusty. And I couldn't understand, was that the clump of bamboo which had captivated me for 8 days out of 9, which looked so beautiful? It was the same bamboo, but because I was now a student again, not a meditator, because I'd just ridden a bicycle for the traffic, because my mind had been doing so much, it was too weak to see the beauty in that clump of bamboo. It's as if the gift of beauty had closed, or rather my mind had closed, and I couldn't see it anymore. This is what happens with power mindfulness. It's based on the stillness of the mind. The more still you keep the mind, the more the energies can go into knowing, and the more powerful that knowing becomes. Later on, you'll experience that. Things which were normal look so beautiful. And it's great when my meditators experience that. You see them just sitting out in the garden, just watching in awe, just a little insect crawl along the ground. And you see them smiling there, and I look at them and they smile back because I know exactly how they're feeling. Carry on, you're doing well. You're enjoying one of the benefits of the meditation, the joy and happiness of power mindfulness. But you take it deeper. After a while, that power of mindfulness really starts to build up, stronger and stronger and stronger. And there are times when your mind becomes so powerful, sometimes you don't know if you can stand it. It is so incredibly strong. When you get that degree of power of mindfulness, you watch the breath and the breath becomes so beautiful very quickly, you get into the stage we call the nimittas, where the mind becomes brilliant. These amazing lights you see in the mind. And you just got so much happiness that sometimes you don't want to sleep or you can't sleep very much. The mind has got too much energy. When that happens, it's not dangerous at all. When people sometimes tell me that after a retreat they can't sleep for the next couple of days, it doesn't matter. Enjoy it. Enjoy it while you have it. Because you've got superpower mindfulness. It's showing you what's possible for your mind. When it's that energized, it doesn't need much sleep. It's got the power, the energy. And it's also incredibly happy. When you have that degree of mindfulness, what we call superpower mindfulness, sometimes your mind is strong enough to go right into the deep states of calm called the jhanas. And they just empower your mind even more. Or you can use them for understanding the nature of the body and the mind. The insight practices. The important part of insight, you have to have a strong mind to be able to see the truth. Not just an ordinary mind. The ordinary mind hasn't got the power. You need a strengthened mind, a solid mind, a powerful mind. And so the happiness which the Buddha said, you should not be afraid of those happinesses which come in meditation from the act of letting go. All it is, it's not craving, it's not attachment, that's part of the doing mind. It's just a passive knowing which has been energized simply by your practice. And it's accompanied by happiness, by joy and by power. And that's when you can start developing these amazing insights. If you want to investigate the nature of the body, the nature of the mind, it's easy to do. But one other interesting thing you can do, which I'm going to talk about later on in more depth, is sometimes when you've got that powerful mindfulness, you can start to remember your past lives, which is a great thing to do as a Buddhist, as a meditator. So often we read about that, that's part of Buddhism, reincarnation, rebirth, but people say, how can you prove that? And I tell them, well, come to one of these retreats and you can prove it. There is a way of proving, and this is it. Get your mind so still and powerful, you get the superpower of mindfulness, and you know that's there when you start to say, look at that big gong over there, and think, wow, look at all those different colors and the texture in that big gong. Wow, that's amazing. You can look at that gong for an hour without getting bored with it. When you have that degree of powerful mindfulness, then your mind is ready to do these sorts of things. You can really develop great insights. But it's not just insights into the nature of the God, it's not just insights into the nature of rebirth. You can also get insights into the nature of life. And your mind is now empowered to do that. In particular, it's empowered to actually to stop some of your bad habits. Sometimes people ask me, Ajahn Brahm, I get angry. How can you teach me how to stop getting angry? Ajahn Brahm, well, I get afraid, I have panic attacks. How can I stop the panic attacks? First of all, empower your mind. When you have empowered mind, you can do what I call programming mindfulness. Programming mindfulness works like this. Say, for example, you have someone, look, let's say it's your husband, and you always tend to say the wrong thing. You always get wound up and say things you're going to regret afterwards. How are you going to stop that bad habit? Because I've seen this with married couples, they bicker to each other, and afterwards they regret it, but it's such a bad habit, they can't stop. And in the end, so the marriages all fall apart. So I tell them, look, you can reprogram your mindfulness. When your husband's not around, this is just an example, it works both ways, to your wife, with your boss, whatever. When they're not around, you make your mind very still and peaceful. You get a bit of mindfulness going, a superpower mindfulness, it works so easily. And then you say, the next time I see my husband, I will say something nice. The next time I see my husband, I'll say something nice. the next time I see my husband, I'll say something nice. Because the passive mind has been empowered, it will be able to listen. That suggestion goes in. And you'll be so surprised that next time you see your husband, you will say something nice. It's like a form of hypnosis. It's called conditioning. What I call programming your mindfulness. And you can do that with so many different character traits which you're trying to abolish in yourself. Whether it's yours, always so fearful. Just say, next time that trigger of the fear comes up, I will not be afraid. Next time it comes up, I will not be afraid. Next time it comes up, I will not be afraid. But that only works when you give clear instructions and you're fully listening, which is where the mindfulness comes. You have to be passively listening when you make those resolutions. And it does work. If you don't believe me, even with ordinary mindfulness, you can try this old trick. When I first did this, it amazed me. I've been teaching it for a long time now. Other people have also started teaching this. Tonight, when you go to sleep, when you think what time you have to get up in the morning, over here it's 5 o'clock. So you don't need to set your alarm clock. If you want to, you can set it 5 past 5. But you just tell yourself, I will wake up at 5 a.m. I will wake up at 5 a.m. I will wake up at 5 a.m. And you'll be so surprised without an alarm clock. You go to sleep, you forget about that, you don't worry about it. At 5 a.m., you wake up. Give 1 or 2 minutes either side. How does that work? You're programming the mind. If you're someone who has many appointments, you don't even need a personal organizer. All you need to do is say, 3 p.m. tomorrow afternoon, I must call my boss. 3 p.m. tomorrow afternoon, I must call my boss. 3 p.m. tomorrow afternoon, I must call my boss. You program it in there, and you listen. What happens? Tomorrow afternoon, 3 p.m., a thought comes in your mind, I must call my boss. It's incredible how well that works if you have mindfulness. And it makes life very, very efficient. Not only can you remember things, but you can actually change some of your character traits. If you're someone in your meditation, you always get afraid at a certain point. You can say, when I get to that stage in meditation, I will not get afraid. When I get to that stage in meditation, I will not be afraid. When I get to that stage in meditation, I will not be afraid. You program it in there. And when you get to that stage, you're not afraid. It's incredible just how powerful mindfulness can become. And how you can make use of it. In a retreat which I gave in Perth, the last retreat I gave in Easter, there was a girl there, a Sri Lankan girl, who was just graduated in medical science, a doctor, from Melbourne University. And she was talking to me that how when she was young, she had this meditation teacher who taught her meditation. She took to it very well. So that when she went to university, doing her med school, she hardly ever went to any tutorials. She went to the lectures, meditated, made herself very mindful and just listened. When the exams came, she meditated, and the first thought, which the first answer which came up after reading the exam paper, she wrote down. She said she came top of the university every year. So it was easy. Because she trained her mind, not only could she get the very, very best marks in the whole university with minimum effort, she could also have plenty of time for play as well. Now, what student wouldn't want to get the best marks with the least effort? This is how you do it. And she's not the first one. Some of the monks in England told me they met this guy who was also went to med school, I think in Exeter University. And he was the same, he'd hardly ever go to lectures even, let alone tutorials. And he would always be missing. But every year he got the very top marks. And what he would do, he'd just read the book. Once was enough. when exams came, always got perfect answers. In the end, he actually didn't practice medicine. He decided to become a meditation teacher instead. Thought it was more effective, could help more people. But that's what can be done with this powerful mindfulness. It's not just in your meditation practice. If you are in business and you really want to be efficient and make it in the world, it's so competitive, sometimes you need that extra edge of mental efficiency, of being alert and aware to your customer's needs or your boss's needs. And with that type of mindfulness, you can do things with far greater efficiency. Which is why even myself, I am the CEO of my monastery. And it's very successful. Now you know one of my secrets. Superpower mindfulness. You do things very quickly and well. And you don't tend to make so many mistakes. Because you're alert. You're aware. The mindfulness has become strong. That's just in life. And if you want to see the truth of the Dhamma, so many different religions, so many different sects within Buddhism, so many different teachers, one teaching one thing, one teaching the other. How can you know for yourself what's right, what's wrong? This is how you can find out. With that superpower mindfulness, you are now equipped to see. You don't need to believe other people. Your mind is so strong. Whatever you look at, whatever you contemplate, you can do so efficiently, so well, so deeply. That's where you become wise, where you gain your insights, where you can check out all the monks and the nuns, all the teachers who sat in a chair like this and find out who has got it right and who hasn't. So, superpower mindfulness. This is what it does for you. But even more than that, one of the great things, it gives you happiness. Happiness in the middle, happiness in the end. It's hard at the beginning to get it going, but once it gets going, you're a happy little meditator. Once, the king Pasenadi of Kosala, this was in the time of the Buddha, just before his death, he went to visit the Buddha in the famous Jetavana monastery, the Jeta Grove, just outside of Sarvati. It's still there to this day. You can go and visit it on pilgrimage, the Jeta Grove monastery. It's the place where the Buddha spent most of his time while he was still alive. And when the king went to see the Buddha, he went into the Buddha's hut and bowed at his feet and started kissing them, because he had such love for the Buddha. But one of the things he said to the Buddha, I love coming to this monastery. I always get so much happiness coming to your monastery. Why is that, great king? Said the Buddha. Because when I come to your monastery, all the monks are happy and smiling. And the Buddha said, that's how it is, great king. When people meditate, and they get results from their meditation, when they get results in their insight, happiness, great king, can be expected. So, one of the signs that your meditation is going well, you don't have to come and tell me, oh, my meditation's going well. I can see it on your face. Those of you who are still miserable, you haven't got the message yet. Those of you sitting there with a big smile on your face, they've understood. That's a sign of superpower mindfulness. The more that mindfulness gets stronger, the more happy you become. And for those of you with sicknesses, that mind power has all sorts of other great benefits for your health. You'll find the diseases can't stand that degree of power. Mindfulness, getting strong, the knowing mind being empowered. That is what superpower mindfulness is. And hopefully the many of you on this retreat, if you have experience in previous retreats, you will experience it on this one. and it's so much fun. When it happens, enjoy it. The Buddha said it's supposed to happen. It's par for the course. It's to be expected. So when it happens, don't think, I can't enjoy this, I'll get attached to it. It's nothing to do with attachment. Enjoy the happiness of the mind which comes from meditation. Indulge in it as much as you like, because it is the path to enlightenment. So, there is a talk on superpower mindfulness. Much stronger than the superpower of Batman, Spider-Man, and who else? Superman, all put together. Superpower mindfulness. You can now be a superpower yogi at this retreat. So, any questions on the superpower path? Any questions anyone has? Anyone interested in psychic powers?
This is where they come from. When your mind is very powerful, it's very, very strong, it's got the bliss of happiness,
then all these little things, they come up. But part of having that strong mindfulness means you have to learn how to let go, you have to learn not to crave, you have to keep good morality and precepts. So there's a safety mechanism in Buddhist psychic powers. If you can't keep your precepts, you lose all your powers. You can't get a strong mind. So it's important to keep your precepts. That's one of the reasons why we give 5 precepts or 8 precepts on a retreat. It gives you the ground so you develop strong mindfulness so that you can have these powers if you need them. So, but we're very, very careful. Any monks who have great powers, we never, ever advertise them. Because if I advertise them, for example, if I decided to levitate in front of you now, that would be the end of me. I would never be able to come to Malaysia again. Instead, I'd have to go to the next Olympic Games, the Commonwealth Games in Melbourne, to represent Australia in the high jump, in the pole vault, because if I could levitate, no one else would have a chance. And if someone found that I could read minds, then the CIA would grab hold of me. They'd first of all take me to Abu Ghraib jail to find out who the terrorists are and who the terrorists aren't. It'd make life much more efficient. They would not need to interrogate them anymore. To say, Ajahn Brahm, please tell me which one's which. And again, I would never be able to come to Impo to teach a retreat again. That's why we always keep these things very quiet. This is where those things come from, because your mind gets empowered. And look, when you get into those deep meditations, you'll feel that power. You understand where these things come from. They're nature. The superpower mindfulness. Wow, your mind gets so strong. It's so powerful and so blissful. It's one, it's great fun. And interesting things happen as well. And that really increases your faith. And if just an ordinary yogi can do that, imagine what the Buddha could do. Wow. Or some of those great monks. Incredible power. But always very kind. So, any questions anyone has? Yes. Yes, he's talking about diseases disappearing for this. It's not. Yeah, yes. There's many cases of that. And it's not just within the Mahasi method. All the other methods, they work as well. So I've had many cases of that, of people actually supposed to die years ago, they're still very much alive. And so I thought this one amazing case, it's an old English guy who keeps coming to my monastery, his name is George. And his story is this: he went to the doctor because he had lung cancer. And the doctor had just done an x-ray, brought him into his rooms, and was looking at the x-ray and showed it to him. Look. And both lungs were full of the cancer, riddled. He said, look, usually what we do with such a cancer is to use surgery. But the whole two lungs are both riddled with the cancer. We can't take out all of your lungs. He said, radiation therapy, chemotherapy, maybe we could add an extra couple of months onto your life, but no more than that, it's just too far gone. But look, he said, go back home, talk it over with your wife, come back in a week's time, we'll do another x-ray to find out how the disease has progressed, and let us know what you want me to do. So George thought he was gone. He went back to his wife and looked. To go through all that radiation chemotherapy just for the next few months of your life, it's just not worth it. So he went back, resigned, just to let nature take its course. The oncologist took the second x-ray. And when he went into the oncologist's room, the oncologist was looking at the new x-ray, shaking his head. And George told me he thought, obviously, it got much worse. So he said, doctor, tell me straight, how many days have I got left? It's got worse, hasn't it? And the oncologist said, George, it hasn't got worse. The reason I'm shaking my head is because it's gone. Completely disappeared within a week. What the hell have you been doing? And George said, meditating. The doctor said, I don't know how it works, but carry on. And George got rid of his lung cancer. He had the two x-rays taken, was it a week or 2 weeks? I can't remember, but it wasn't longer than 2 weeks, 10 days maybe. 2 weeks or 10 days apart. And one was completely incurable. And it was actually, you know, on the x-ray there, in black and white. And the next couple of weeks it had gone. That's why he keeps coming to my monastery now. So this has happened, this one example. How does that work? When you understand what superpower mindfulness is and the power of the mind, you can understand how that works. So many diseases are stress related. That's why that I was in Singapore last weekend, last Sunday, 6 days ago, visiting a lady in the NUH hospital, the university hospital. And there was ward after ward after ward of cancer patients. The number of cancer patients has increased enormously. And why is that? So it's because of our stressful lifestyles. So if you learn how to meditate, you relax the stress, then you don't tend to get these cancers. You live much longer. Just relax. Let go. Stop doing things. And become just more knowing, more relaxed, not reacting. So there's many health benefits. Even one of my monks, he'd only just become a monk. I went with him when we went to give blood, to donate blood. Before he was a monk, he used to work for the electricity utility in Perth. A high flyer there with a very demanding job, with lots of stress. But he's also a kind lay Buddhist before he became a monk, so he'd always give blood there when he was working as a layperson. So when he went to give blood, I was standing next to him, and the nurse had all his records. The first thing they do is take your blood pressure. And the nurse took his blood pressure, noted it down, and said, hey, your blood pressure's really gone down. And then she looked at him and said, because she saw he was a monk now, you haven't been meditating, have you? And the nurse asked that. He said, of course, I'm a monk now. I said, oh, that explains it. I always remember that. It was years ago. Even the nurses knew that if you meditate, your blood pressure goes down. So much so that a lot of people in our centre, they're actually referred by their doctors to come and learn meditation. go to the center over there, learn some meditation. It lessens your blood pressure. That's only one thing. It increases your immune system. So many things it does. So there are magic cures. If it's not magic cures, at least it prolongs life and health. You can feel just the power of the mindfulness when you really get it going. But if you worry a lot, you're doing so much, the energy can't go into mindfulness. It goes into reacting. So please remember that the two parts of the mind, the passive knowing mind, the active doing mind, you do too much. In this meditation retreat, don't do anything. Just know. Be mindful. Allow the energy to flow into the knowing mind. Don't go criticizing yourself, saying, I've been lazy today, nothing's happening. That's more doing, reacting. Make peace with whatever is happening. Allow it to be. Have loving kindness. The door of my heart is open to this moment, no matter what it is. Unconditional mindfulness. Then you're so passive that after a while the nature happens and your mindfulness gets naturally strong without you doing it. It's just a natural cause and effect. Thank you for that question. Did I answer it enough? Any other question about superpower mindfulness? Yes. Hi. Oh, yeah. To achieve invincibility. Okay, is that Buddhist? Okay. You will never achieve invincibility. You may get stronger, but eventually the death will conquer you eventually. Your old age and sickness. There are some things which we can conquer, there's some things which we have to just accept. But what was interesting there, that even though the goal was one thing, not a very wise God, but still he got some idea of what meditation can do. So sometimes it's nice to see the power of meditation, just how it can, if it's like bouncing you around, give you energy, and whatever else it is. But at least it has that power. It's not just a belief thing. It's an empowering thing. And once he develops that type of mind, then if he just goes and focuses, if it's on his business or focuses on Dhamma, you'll have a powerful mind to get deeply into it. Once you have that degree of power, then if you start talking about anicca, dukkha, anatta, especially this non-self business, so many people have a lot of trouble with understanding what no self is, simply because their mind's not powerful enough to see it. But after a while, when you really empower your mind, then you can actually see those things. So I don't care what people do it for. It's for invincibility. Okay, but no, it's not going to work, but at least you're going to get something which is useful useful for other things. It's good training. Like some people join the military. And sometimes, like some of the disciples in Singapore, they have to join up. And they say, I'm a Buddhist. And what happens if I have to kill somebody? I give Ajahn Chah's advice. Look, if you're in a firefight, first of all, train well, so you know how to shoot the gun, you're accurate. If you're in a firefight, you're a Buddhist, make sure you shoot over the heads. Because no one will know what you're doing. But the point is that it's good discipline. So I tell all the Buddhists, a chance of you having a firefight or doing something like that is very light. It's service for your country, you have to do this, it's your duty. And you get great self-discipline there. And you can make use of that later on in your life for when you're a Buddhist or whatever. So it's good, make use of it. There's always something which we can make use of. But the worst is, the worst thing is that people have to pay so much money for those courses. And they can come and they can get much better teachings here for free. The trouble is most people think if you don't have to pay for it, it can't be worth anything. Which is crazy. And that's why there's a story in my little book there that some years ago, there's one of our monks, quite a famous teacher, Ajahn Sumedho, many of you might know him. He received a telephone call some years ago from an American woman in London. The phone conversation went like this. The American woman said, "Venerable sir, I hear you teach meditation." He said, "Yes, I'm a meditation teacher." She said, "How much do you charge?" He said, "Nothing, madam, it's free." She replied, "It's free? Well, that means you can't be any good then." And she hung up the phone. It's crazy because most people would do that. They think if it's free, it can't be any good. But if I charge, if I go into some big hotel in KL, and I, instead of having a bald head, I wear a wig and put on a sharp suit and charge people $1,000 US a day, not ringgit, US dollars a day, I'm sure I could pack that hotel without any problem at all. There's a con sometimes. That's why these days when sometimes people say, "How much does the meditation retreat cost?" We never ever say it's free. We say it's priceless. The retreat is priceless. In other words, you don't have to pay anything, no price. But it's priceless, which means it sounds very expensive. This truth gives value to these teachings. So the meditation which you learn here is priceless. Priceless Dhamma. Can I have a cup? So sometimes you think, well, you don't need to go to these expensive commercial meditation retreats. You can get as good, if not better, teachings free from your monks and nuns. Next question. Yeah, go on. Okay, faith healing. What actually happens? Have you ever seen a faith healing? A lot of times there's a lot of energy going on. So first of all, there is a lot of like power of the mind happening. There's also this incredible power of belief. Because the mind is extremely powerful. It can heal you, but it can also kill you. In Australia, amongst the Aboriginal communities, if there's any member of that community commits a crime against their laws, they haul them into a meeting of the elders. And the elders say that you've done that crime. And what they do is they get a bone, they point the bone at the offender. And the offender will always die within 2 or 3 days of having the bone pointed at them. Their belief in that is so strong, they do die. And there's been many other examples. If you believe you're going to die, that you do die. One of the grossest examples, which I've often quoted, happened over 100 years ago in Bristol Prison, in England, where there was a poor man who was condemned to death by hanging for some crime. The night before his execution, 2 scientists, with approval of the governor of the prison, went to this man's cell and told him that the law had been changed. They were lying. The law had been changed. He would still die the following morning, but not by hanging. He would have his throat cut the following morning. And they left this poor man to think about that all night. What a terrible thing to do. That someone believing that the last night on earth, the following morning, they'd be executed by having their throat cut. Just before dawn, the guards came for him, tied his hands securely behind the back, put on a blindfold and led him to the place of execution. The place of execution, they did the formalities of reading out the sentence and the punishment, giving him the last rites with his religious representative. And then one of the guards drew the knife across his throat. He fell down and died. That's what he thought. But actually what happened was they took him to the washrooms, the prison washrooms. One of the guards drew a blunt knife across his throat, which didn't even leave a scratch. At the same time, one of the scientists turned on one of the taps. This man felt the cold steel across his throat, heard liquid pouring out. He thought he had his throat cut, and he fell down to the ground and died, simply because of the power of belief. That's well documented in the scientific journals of UK. It happens. If you believe you're going to die, you do. If you believe you're going to live, you do. The power of faith, the power of the mind is that strong. So it's not a religious thing, it's a psychological thing. It's not the power of God or Jesus, it's the power of the mind. That's how it works. Otherwise, you'd only see it in one religion or other religions. It happens in all religions, and even sometimes in no religions, through the power of, say, hypnosis, where people are given that same belief just by the power of a hypnotist. So it's incredible how powerful the mind is. Once you realize that, and especially with superpower mindfulness, you can use that powerful mind in many, many wonderful ways. That's how it works. Yes? How powerful does the mind have to be before you can cure yourself? Okay, the more powerful, the more chance there is to cure yourself. But sometimes it depends also on the karma of that illness. Sometimes the karma of that illness is so strong that even the most powerful mind cannot stop it. But the more powerful it is, the more chance you have. If you enter the jhanas, you get an incredibly powerful mind. But even entering the jhanas, sometimes you can't stop these things. They're karma. Sometimes the karma is so strong. There's some karmas which are so strong, you just can't stop them. But sometimes the karma is not so strong, and your mind is more powerful, and you can overcome them. So there's no black and white answer, but you can actually see how this works. The stronger the karma, the more power you need to overcome it. The more powerful the mind, the more possibilities there are for you. Any other questions on superpower mindfulness? On the question of health, the many of you who are meditating here, you may come across an interesting experience in the course of your meditation. You may be sitting here quite calmly, quite peacefully, getting into a reasonably deep meditation, but you might find that part of your body suddenly becomes very hot. If you have hot spots in the body during that stage of meditation, don't do anything about it, leave it alone and feel quite glad. Because what happens is that that's a sign that there must be something wrong in that part of the body, some sickness or some imbalance. And it's the energies of the body, because you're relaxing and being free, the energies of the body can now flow freely to that part of the body, and there's some sort of healing going on. I mention this because so often people said they were meditating, they got really hot in their elbows, or women in their breasts or somewhere. And a lot of the time it's because there's some healing going on there. On the last retreat, this woman came up to me, she said, the last meditation, I want to talk to you about this. I was sitting there, I was getting quite peaceful, and suddenly, just my whole back got so hot, it's like it was on fire. What's going on? It spooked me. And the first question I asked was, madam, have you had any physical problems with your back? At which she laughed. How did you know, Ajahn Brahm? He said, look, I didn't know. It's obvious. You've been getting peaceful, and once you're peaceful, the energies have gone to that area to try and heal it. This is what happens in meditation. In Chinese medicine, the qi has a chance to flow. All illness is supposed to be a blockage of those energies. It's the same in the Indian system. In the time of the Buddha, they called it winds flowing through the body, which got blocked. And once you relax, those winds start to flow again. And when they flow, very often there's some place which is sick. They all flow to that one place, all the energies go to that one place, and you experience it as, you know, some sort of heat there. And if you could look at that place, it's probably all red. And it's great when that happens, you've got some healing going on. So don't interrupt it, it'd be good for you. And you feel so much better afterwards. So that's actually part of the process of healing happening in meditation. Got a hot spot somewhere. Or sometimes things like jerk. If things jerk during the meditation, don't think it's you. You're not a jerk. It's just the body jerking, that's all. And it's just, you know, some sort of blockage is just suddenly being released. This guy who was meditating on one of my retreats in Sydney some years ago, he had cancer of the sinuses. And he told me that coming to the retreat was his last chance. He was about to die. And he, I remember him very clearly because he always used to say, look, I've lived a good life, I'm ready to die. He said, the only one thing which I really get upset with is people never live up to their potential. That, you know, they have an opportunity to do things, they don't take those opportunities. He said, but I took my opportunities, I've been in business, I've travelled, I've lived a good life, I'm ready to die. And because of his sinus cancer, his whole nose was all blocked. The only way he could breathe was through his mouth. And so when he was sitting there doing the meditation, he was it was really noisy. And one day I got a letter, a little note on my seat there. It was a complaint. They say, can you tell some people to be quiet when they're breathing? It's disturbing my meditation. So when I read that and I said, listen, the reason that gentleman is breathing so loudly, he's got incurable cancer, he's only got 1 or 2 months to live, this is his last shot for peace. And when I said that, there's no more complaints, only compassion. Well, on the second to last day of the retreat, when he came for the interview, he reported that he had been meditating, and in his own words, he heard a pop. And he could breathe again through his nose. So it was incredible. He didn't know how that happened. He experienced a pop. And breath could come up one of the nostrils. It closed again 15 minutes later. He said it was amazing. I don't know why this happened. But somehow the cancer had receded. And I thought that, well, you know, he got somewhere, but it's not enough to really cure him. I thought he'd certainly die. But last year when I was in Sydney teaching meditation in a small group, this guy came up to me and said, do you remember me? I said, no, I don't remember you. He said, I was that guy who was dying of cancer. I've been in remission for some time now, healthy, but a meditator. He cured his incurable cancer as well. And he said, this is actually what happened as part of that cure. When he was meditating there and heard a pop, and that's the first time for months he could breathe through his nose. He carried on later on. More pops, more time, cancer receded. Can be done. So if you all get these hot spots, allow them to happen. Superpower mindfulness can do all sorts of amazing things. Pass your degrees with ease, great results, great business, great being a doctor, being creative. A superpower mindfulness, training your mind. Not enough people train their mind these days, especially your poor kids. The competition at schools and universities is so great that you really need to give your kids a special advantage. And if you can teach them how to meditate, oh, they're going to do so well. You're up their grades. There was one of my disciples she was a deputy principal at a primary school, she was teaching meditation to grade sixes. And many of these were from Christian families. So she never called it meditation, she called it quiet time. Exactly the same as we call it quiet time, not meditation. She gave it a bit of a spin, as they say these days. And the headmaster, the principal, was really supportive. When I went to see him, I said, "Do you get any complaints about this girl so teaching Buddhist meditation?" Because a few people found out she was a Buddhist. He said, "Look, I do get a few complaints, but I just tell the parents, I've seen this lady, this deputy principal, teaching over the last 4 or 5 years, and I notice that that class does very, very well, not only academically, but also emotionally as well." He said, "I'm really impressed with what that class does. The quiet time means that the children have got greater concentration, they learn more, they learn better." And they said, "An amazing thing happens that when they were meditating in this class, quiet time, they usually start 5 minutes at the beginning of the year, they get up to about 15 minutes by the end of the year. They said, whenever there was an argument in the class, and there was about to be some sort of tension, one of the kids will put up their hand and said, 'Miss, can we have quiet time now?' And everybody would sit down and meditate for 5 minutes. And that way there was always harmony in that class. They never had any sort of fights or disharmony at all. Quiet time was a way of solving their problems." And also she found out, or they found out, that even the boys got to be very caring. And they saw one of the other kids in the class was upset for some reason or another, maybe something happened at home, they would all crowd around. From the peace came compassion, which is wonderful to see. There's the power of mindfulness in schools as well. Should go there again and again and again. Don't need to call it Buddhist, call it just quiet time. So it's time for you to be quiet. And it's time for me to be quiet, because it's 9:30. Is there any more questions, or shall we finish up now? There's another question, make it the last question from the back, yeah. You can create any what, sorry? Yes. Ah. Okay. You're asking if someone has superpower mindfulness, can you create many realities, like having your neighbor who may be angry at you be peaceful, making other people maybe rich or whatever? You can only, with superpower mindfulness, you can only do positive things, because if you start to using that power of the mind for negative things, in other words, what's the negative things? Someone's upset you, your business competitor is doing much better than you, and you want to try and use superpower mindfulness to make them poor, get them into trouble with the police. If it's a negative thing, it will never work. If it's a positive thing, it does work. I'll tell you a story. I don't know if I told this last time about, there's a Thai monk called Ajahn Jamnian. Ajahn Jamnian, have you heard the story about how he got his diplomatic visa for the United States? And this is a great story to finish off with. Shows you the power of superpower mindfulness. Recently, this monk, who would be, he's very, very old, he must be in his 80s now, a Thai monk, lives in the south of Thailand. Recently, he went to visit one of our monasteries in California, one of Ajahn Chah's monasteries. When the monk picked him up at the airport, he noticed in his passport, he had a lifetime diplomatic visa to enter the United States. Now this is a very rare visa to get, especially for a monk. Now in these days of homeland security in the US, what were they doing giving this monk permission to come and go as he pleased as a diplomat? And so he asked where this visa would come from. And the monk told the story. A year or two before, in Texas, in Houston, in the headquarters of NASA, the National Aeronautical and Space Agency, they'd installed a new mainframe computer. It cost many, many millions of dollars. And once it was installed, they could not get it to work properly. Being such an important part of the US, they got the very best experts to try and fix up the problems. No matter what they paid these experts, no matter how many they got, they could not fix this problem in the mainframe computer at NASA. It was costing tens of millions a day, as long as this was out of order. So they were getting desperate. One of the engineers made a suggestion. If we can't fix it, then we are the experts. Perhaps it's something supernatural. This monk, Ajahn Jamnian, happened to be in Houston at the time. So they invited him in to NASA. He went there into the headquarters, into the mainframe computer room. And there he did some metta meditation, a little bit of chanting, and at the end of the chanting, the computer worked perfectly. And they were so grateful that this monk had saved them so many millions of dollars and helped an important part of the United States government that they used the contacts with NASA had to get this monk a diplomatic visa for the rest of his life so he could come and go from the United States whenever he wanted. That is a true story. The second part of this true story, please keep this to yourselves. Is there anybody here who works for, say, Malaysia Air or for Singapore Airlines? Anyone in the airline industry? Please keep this secret. Because when this monk arrived off the airport, he was carrying about three or four knives, six screwdrivers, pliers, on his body, on his under jacket, we call the ANXA. He had so many pockets. This monk is famous for all the pockets he has. He had all this metal. And as soon as he came out, and the abbot of Abhayagiri, Ajahn Basna, saw him, his eyes popped. You can't go through the security system like that. Even like one knife, you'd be branded a terrorist. You'd be caught. How did you do that? You get all that stuff in the cabin of the plane. He said, oh, it's easy. Every time I go through that detector, I just meditate. Superpower mindfulness. Never catches me, not once. That's true. There's this monk. Fortunately, you can only have superpower mindfulness if you're a good person. You've got precepts. So there's no danger from terrorism from monks like that. Carries all this stuff through all the security systems. Nothing can catch him. Simply because super power mindfulness. The power of his mind. Great story. So if you want any of your computers fixed, get into super power mindfulness and you go zap, zap, zap and they're all okay. Go on. So yeah. The computer is not a living thing. How can the mind get involved in that? Well, actually, I don't know. I mean, I've never seen him since that happened. There may have been something supernatural getting involved in there. Who knows? And just driving these things out with your mind. Who knows? But it's also like mind over matter. The mind can interfere with things. Even years ago, there was this Tibetan monk I used to go and see. He told me that he was over in the in hospital for something or other, and the nurses had to complain to him, stop messing around with the machines, because they have this, something like an ECG on him, just measuring his heartbeat,
And he'd be there all day, just, you know, in the hospital bed, just watching this machine with all these blips on it. So he decided to play around with it. And then make sure that it goes straight, and then blip, 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 straight, and whatever he was doing, just messing around. He's getting a bit bored in the hospital. And he's messing up the whole sort of machine. Just stop it. So he had to behave himself. These things do happen, all coming from the power of the mind.
Do those things.
Okay, I think that's enough for tonight. So let's do the sharing of merits. And with your superpower mindfulness, maybe these merits might go to exactly where they should. Itam men yatinam hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Itam men yatinam hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Itam men yatinam hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Yeah. Okay. So those of you who are going home, please go home safely. You've got 25 minutes to get out before the gate shuts. I know you're staying here. Have a nice night. If you want to meditate some more, please do so. Want to go to bed, please do so. And see you in the morning. Have a nice night.